look. That's the bottom line, he said. The Russians set the international prices for wheat and corn, and they've set them 8% lower than last year. The president lifted her chin a notch and held back the anger and frustration that was welling up inside her. For long moments, no one around the table said a word. Through the French doors at her back, the president could hear a robin singing out in the rose garden. She glanced up at the portrait of Franklin Roosevelt over the fireplace at the far end of the room. "How I wish I had your boundless confidence," Jane Scanwell said silently to the jaunty FDR. "Nothing to fear but fear itself. If only it was that simple." The vice president, sitting directly across the table from her, was scowling like the New England school teacher he had once been. He had been the Senate majority leader and a power to be reckoned with. Once Jane had succeeded her husband, she had plucked this scrawny, severe, latter-day Daniel Webster out of the Senate and made him vice president, where he could do her no harm. She was beginning to realize, though, that he could no longer do her any good either. 8% lower, the vice president muttered. But they can't. Yes, they can, agriculture snapped. The damned commies set their price, and the rest of the world market falls right into line with them. The Secretary of Defense, once a post so important that he always sat at the president's right hand, said from the foot of the table, "We could refuse to sell at that price. Hold back the grain until the price goes up a little." Agriculture shook his head. "The other food exporting countries will undercut us. Argentina, Australia, Canada." The president turned to the Secretary of State. Like most of the cabinet officers, he had been her husband's appointee. She had not replaced them with her own choices. Not yet. "Can we negotiate agreements with the other food exporters?" she asked. "Bilateral agreements with each individual nation?" he asked. He was a former Dallas banker, a slim, elegant Hispanic with distinguished silvery hair and deep brown eyes that had a strange, slightly oriental cast to them. Jane thought of him as a department store mannequin, a figure of wax that displays clothes well. She imagined that he slept in a three-piece pinstripe suit of gray or navy blue. "I was thinking," she replied, "more of a multilateral situation, sort of the kind that the oil-producing nations had back in the 70s.
"You mean OPEC?"
"Yes, that's it. An OPEC for the nations that export food." He pursed his lips, as if seriously considering the idea for a moment, then said flatly, "The Russians would never allow it." "You don't think?" He gave the president a patient little smile.
"The men in the Kremlin would never permit anything that interfered with their ability to set the world price for grain and other foodstuffs. To think we could get around that in some way is idle dreaming."
"You condescending little prick," the president raged inwardly. "It's smug little bastards like you who got us into this mess in the first place." The Treasury Secretary looked up from the pocket computer he had been fiddling with.
"An 8% drop in the price we get for food exports is going to mean a significant increase in unemployment."
The president leaned back in her chair and let them take up that theme. "They don't understand," she told herself. "They can't see far enough to understand. If we can hold out, if we can just hang on for long enough, we'll win. In the long run, we can win if we don't destroy ourselves first." While the cabinet officers argued hotly over just what percentage of the nation's workforce would be laid off and what this would mean to the national economy and the value of the deflated dollar overseas and to her chances for re-election in November, she let her mind drift to the message she had received that morning. "I knew he'd come crawling back," Jane Scanwell told herself. "It's taken more than 3 years, but he's finally begging to see me." "Maybe begging is too strong a word," she warned herself. "Dan Hamilton never begs. He's too proud to bend his knees. But he wants to see me. He needs my help." Cold anger seeped along her veins like a river of ice engulfing her. "He needs my help," she repeated, savoring the thought. "When I needed his help, he ran away. Left the country, left Morgan to die and me to carry on alone. Now he wants to come back. To be forgiven." "Never," she told herself. "I'll see him burn in hell before I lift a finger to help him. I'll see the Russians hang him in Red Square first."
Dan Randolph hovered weightlessly, his boots a good 4 inches off the floor of the locker room, as the two technicians checked out his spacesuit. His helmet floated before him within easy reach, turning and drifting ever so slightly, like a severed head slowly turning its face away from him. "It's been months since I've been up here," Dan realized. "I shouldn't let so much time pass between visits." It had surprised him that he had felt slightly queasy for the first few hours in zero gravity. After all the hundreds of times he had flown into orbit, he thought he had left the butterflies of zero-G far behind. "That's what you get for staying on the ground too long," he told himself. "It's your punishment for sticking in the mud instead of being up here where you belong." In the few hours since his shuttle had docked at the space station, the uneasy malaise gradually disappeared, to be replaced by the euphoria and pleasure of weightlessness. Dan felt as if he had left all the cares of Earth far behind him. He was in a new world now, in his own element, free and happy. "Can't you guys go any faster?" he complained. The chief technician, a toothsome blonde with a healthy tan and the confident smile of a woman who knew her business, gave him a disarming smile. "Mr. Randolph, sir," she said, "we're responsible for your safety. We don't want the big boss to get killed because we missed a pinhole leak in his spacesuit, now do we?"
"We don't want the big boss to die of old age before he gets out the airlock, either," Dan jabbed back. She laughed.
"We're careful, boss, not slow." He grumbled and muttered good-naturedly as they completed their check of his suit, its radio, its life support backpack, and the jet maneuvering unit that embraced him like the back and two arms of a chair that had no seat or legs. At last, Dan put on his helmet, sealed the collar, and slid the visor down and locked it in place. The crew chief flashed him a toothy grin and said, "You are cleared for EVA, sir." Dan barely heard her from inside the helmet, but he had learned to read lips years ago. He floated over to the inner airlock hatch and entered the round metal chamber. Airlocks always reminded Dan of stainless steel wombs. This one was bigger than most, large enough to accommodate half a dozen astronauts at once, or a fair amount of bulky equipment. Its metal walls were dulled by years of scratching and scuffing, but the labels on the inner and outer control panels had been freshly sprayed on. Dan could read them clearly. He knew them by heart, of course. The technicians inside the space station were monitoring the airlock. Automatic fail-safe systems would not allow a neophyte to kill himself by opening the hatches in the wrong order. It was a common understanding among the men and women who worked in space that a person who was careless enough to get killed probably deserved it. But the sloppy son of a bitch usually took somebody else with him, sometimes more than one other person. An airlock accident could wipe out everybody on the other side of the inner hatch, so both human and machine monitors watched the airlocks constantly. The air pumped out of the metal womb and the control panel light next to the outer hatch turned green. Dan drifted over to it and leaned a thumb against the glowing plastic button. The hatch swung open without a sound, and Dan glided out into the emptiness of space, a newborn leaving the womb. For a breathless moment, he hovered just outside the open hatch, reveling in the glory of it. The Earth revolved slowly, immense, filling half the sky, incredibly clean and glowing, purest blues and greens of the shining seas, swirls of dazzling white clouds that hid whole continents beneath their vast expanse. Dan gazed at it, the home of the human race. It looked so serene and beautiful from this distance. It took a real effort of will to pull his attention away from the endlessly fascinating world that lay before him and focus on the factory that hung less than 5 kilometers away. It was an ungainly, almost ugly collection of metal pods, cylinders, connecting tubes, crisscrossing beams, and big paddle-shaped solar collectors that stretched their arms out to the unfiltered sunlight like the dark rectangular leaves of some alien extraterrestrial tree, drinking in solar energy and converting it silently, efficiently, to the electricity that the factory needed. In a way, the factory reminded Dan of an old typesetting machine that he had once seen in an ancient printing shop back in rural Virginia when he had been a child. A clinking, clanking collection of moving mechanical arms and vats of molten lead. The heart of the space factory was the smelter, where ores from the moon were refined into pure elements, aluminum, titanium, silicon, oxygen. The factory itself had been built mostly of lunar metal.